Blog Talk Radio.
Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I'm just pumped about the show tonight because we have too much to talk about. It's one of these shows that, Rush Limbaugh has nothing on us as far as our stack of stuff tonight. I mean, we could literally do a 3-hour show, and
could easily do a 3-hour show. Well, often we could probably do a 3-hour show on one topic, but But what we've got is so many topics that we'll never get through them all.
No chance.
I said before the show, it's okay because there's always another show. We can always do it next week. But then you made a really interesting. You had a really interesting response to that, and I think we should probably start with that observation. Go ahead.
Well, let me just mention that one of the things that I'm fired up about is the fact that since last week, this announcement's been made that a single atom transistor has been made, and it's been made 8 to 10 years ahead of schedule, which virtually ends Moore's law. By the way, I mean you can't get smaller than a single atom for a transistor, and so the next step is quantum computers after that. So my point is, with that news, we're so close to the singularity at this point that things will happen so fast, we probably should have the show every hour on the hour because that's how fast things will happen now. So anyway.
Yeah, the point being there's no catching up. To my glib, we can do another show next week. Between now and next week, there will be so much incremental more stuff that it's simply not it's not possible for us to cover it all, and you know what? It probably never has been possible for us to cover it all. We've only ever covered the ones that got our attention. But now we can't even do justice to the ones that capture our attention. But you know what? We're going to try. We're nothing if not dedicated to getting the word out there about the fact that things are getting better. And in that vein, we have launched a new blog, Better All the Time. You can go to www.betterallthetime.com. An extension of. This is the rebirth of what used to be a feature over on The Speculist that we would do ideally every other week. I don't think we ever did it every other week all that often, but it was a fun feature where we would collect the best of the best good news stories, the stories that really show that things are taking off, that things are heading in the right direction, big positive changes that are occurring. And we would collect usually 10, I think, 9 or 10 of those together, and we would run through them and say, here's why this is good news, here's why this is good news. And now we've got a site dedicated just to that. So I am trying to keep up with the good news as it occurs, and to your point, Stephen, it's impossible to do. I will be enlisting some help on that. I'm looking for good writers who have an interest in blogging and who'd like to be part of Better All the Time. So I'll be putting out some notices on Facebook and elsewhere about that in the weeks to come. So we might get some help tracking that. But all that's to say, we know we're not going to be able to keep up because I think you're right. I think we're to use a negative image. swirling the drain here on the singularity.
If we're swirling the drain in the best possible way.
It's a black hole. It's a beautiful black hole of goodness, though. That's the point about the singularity. So we're going to jump right into these things. I think let's not be shy. And I know you've got a bunch of them. Let me start with what's the top story currently at Better All the Time, a story we'll be talking about frequently on this program, just as we did a predecessor book, The Rational Optimist. The book Abundance by Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler is out this week. Stephen, you've got your copy. You've been reading it. You've been tweeting it. You've been very excited about it, and I'm looking forward to getting my print copy. We seem to be keeping in line with our old bet. With you getting the Kindle edition and me getting the print copy. But I actually I was enticed by all these additional offers that they made to people who pre-ordered a print copy of the book. So I'm looking forward to that. I noticed they put a big thing up on Facebook today to all the people who had pre-ordered. Yes, your book's on the way. It'll be here in 5 to 7 business days. We're going to send you an email. Don't worry. Don't panic. I guess a lot of people are like me. They have friends who already have the Kindle edition, and they're going crazy because they don't get to read it. So how far into it are you, and what do you think so far?
It's an absolutely brilliant book. You're going to love it, Phil. I would say I'm about 3/4 of the way through. It's an easy read. This is, I've been sipping Rocket Men like a fine, like a fine scotch or something. I've been enjoying it little by little by little. And
right.
Which is a great, it's a great book, and I've enjoyed, making my way through that book slowly. I am sprinting through Abundance, you can't really compare the two books. They're completely different sorts of books, but I'm, just very much enjoying it also, but in a very different way, because I'm just absorbing it and having a good time with it. Some of the things that he says in this book, we've been saying for years. Just for example, this whole business about, if it bleeds, it leads, and why don't we ever hear good news? And maybe we got a role to fill here. He spent some time talking about that. When we developed as a species, we were always on the lookout for that thing that's going to kill us next, and so we default to to the bad news. The bad news is something that catches our attention. And so that sells newspapers. It's not reflective of reality, though. And then he spends the rest of the book explaining what reality, what is the reality? The reality is we've got a lot to be thankful for already, and the future is even brighter.
Yeah, the thing is, I think that they probably don't use our formula, but it sounds like it's very much in line with our 80-20 calculation, right, which is that throughout all of human history, 80% of our effort at least had to be focused on just not dying, right? On just not getting wiped out and preventing horrible things from happening. And at very best, 20% of our attention was left over to try to optimize outcomes and try to make the good things happen. And somewhere in our lifetimes, that has flipped, okay? And we should actually be about 80% focused on the optimal outcomes, only about 20% focused on the bad stuff, and the world hasn't caught up to that perspective yet. But it sounds like this book is all about that perspective.
He spent some time talking about how in the developing world, one of the reasons people have such large families in the developing world is for that 80-20 on a familial scale. In other words, 80% of the kids in the family are either going to die in infancy. Our need to basically work for the survival of the family, and maybe you have one kid that might have a chance of getting out, and basically maybe perhaps increasing the likelihood that the family might be bettered somewhat. He says one of the big things about when a country becomes developed is that the birth rate drops, and part of it is that you don't have to have as many kids when half your kids are not dying in infancy, and it's not one of these situations where, five people have to work just to make sure that there's enough food, while one person has a chance to make it. Everyone has a chance to make it. in a developed country. So, yeah, I mean, it's thick with stuff. I mean, I can't do it justice to talk about what it's about, Harlan, because it's really a great book that encompasses so much.
Well, I linked to the Wall Street Journal review on Facebook, and I was reading that review, and even though we hear these facts all the time and we're as immersed in this kind of stuff as two people can possibly hope to be, I'm still astounded by some of the things I'm reading. And did I get this right, or did I just imagine this? But by 2035, at the current rate, the entire world will be lifted out of poverty. By current definitions of poverty, poverty will no longer exist by 2035. Is that right?
On the trajectory we're on, absolutely.
On the trajectory we're on, yeah. If we can stay on.
I mean, it's not like things have to change completely for this to happen. No, this is the path we're on right now. Even in the midst of this recession, the world itself is marching on, and that's awesome news. That's very cool.
Unbelievably exciting. Well, I'm looking forward to getting the book, looking forward to reading it. I have reached out to the authors to see if there's any way we can get one of them on. Obviously, Peter Diamandis is a guy we've wanted to talk to anyhow, somebody that we had targeted for The World Transformed in the past, and he's probably really busy right now. And we've had better luck with some of these kinds of folks a little after their books have been out for a while. So we'll see what we're able to do. But we'll do a show on it here in the near future. Whether we get somebody from the book or not, because I think we're just going to have too much to say about it, not to do a show about it.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's keep moving. We got a lot of ground to cover, Stephen. What's on your list?
I just wanted to mention in the book Abundance, he mentions that every major car company now has an autonomous motor car division. You know, a division within the company that is working on automated cars. And there's been a lot of news about that this week. For example, Nevada now, being very forward-thinking about things, has passed some regulations about autonomous cars. They, starting March of this year, if you're driving around in Nevada and you see a red license plate on a car, that is, and you see, and you're alarmed because you can't see a driver in the car. Well, don't be. That's a autonomous car. It's meant to be that way. So, it's not just so forward thinking that this thing may happen in 5 years. They really are driving autonomous cars in Nevada. So let me
get this straight. So you're driving along and you see a car with a red license plate.
Right.
Now, I would have thought that in Nevada, a red license plate would mean something else. there's no reason to identify that.
That's the red light. That's in the window. It's not
no reason to put that right on somebody's plates, I guess. They don't identify
exactly.
My job on a license plate. But the point is, there are currently robot cars driving in Nevada. Is this one of the places where obviously one of the places where Google's running their tests?
Yeah, and you can see why. They've been doing a lot in California. I think that Nevada, the neighboring state there, lots of open highways.
Yeah,
it's kind of ideal for that, and it's been ideal for testing a lot of things, hasn't it, Phil? So, in Nevada sort of has an open mind about
it. It's a good place to try things out, all kinds of
right.
Social models and, try all
exactly.
kinds of business models, all kinds of things get tried out in Nevada. But it actually is a terrific state for that, just because you've got interstates cutting through there. You've got a lot of local roads. You've got mountain roads. I mean, and it's not nearly as densely populated as California. So, you've got significant advantages over that. You've got both the big transportation infrastructure and the, other than Las Vegas, really sparse population. So, the two things work together pretty nicely, I'm thinking. That's going to be kind of exciting to see. Now I'm looking forward next time I'm in Nevada to see if I can spot a car with a red license plate. I don't think they'll be that prominent all at once, but that's pretty forward thinking of the state legislature, I presume, in that state to already be licensing that distinct kind of vehicle. They're saying that this is a legitimate legal thing, which you know, I haven't heard about how it was done in California, but I always just kind of assumed that these Google guys started doing this sort of on the sly without going and asking for permission first. Do you know anything about whether that's the case or whether what they're doing is considered legal?
Well, and they just were doing it. And it's, you know, the thing is with law, if it's not against the law, then it's legal, you know. And so it's, you know, that's how some of these designer drug guys stay out of jail. You know, they come up with a new recreational drug, they put it out on the market until the legislature goes, oh, we got to outlaw this, and then it gets outlawed, and then he's on to the next drug by then. You know, those recreational chemists they stay out of jail that way. I guess that's a bad analogy, I guess, to put Google.
No,
in,
but it makes the
more.
Point. It makes the point. You're staying ahead of legislation. But here, in any case,
here in Nevada, says okay, yeah, let's bring it on. We want it. And you know, I had an interesting conversation with someone who had no idea about this this week. I was just having lunch with a local doctor, and he had heard about it. He just brought it up, and. And I said, and he asked me what I thought about it, and I basically said, well, you know, it's going to be awesome. I mean, think about it. These things don't blink; they're not distracted by the kids in the back seat. They don't,
right.
You know, they're not.
They don't
not
get drunk.
Be caught.
They don't get
drunk. They don't.
Yeah.
And they don't get distracted by their cell phones or texting. These,
they don't get mad at other drivers. I mean, they just,
they just do the job, and they don't speed. You know, they'll obey the traffic regulations much better than we do. And so, do I think it's going to happen? Absolutely. And he looks at me and says, aren't you you're a personal injury lawyer? And I said, yeah, I'll be out of a job. It's okay. I'll find something else to do, and I'll be happy about it because, you know, I've seen a lot of Maine people in my office, and it's not a fun thing. So I'm excited about it. It's gonna be awesome. So
I think so too. I think it's an extremely exciting development, very cool that it's legal in at least one state. The one state where things are often legal that other states, you know, take their time in following suit. But we'll see how long before it becomes legal for robots to drive cars everywhere.
I saw a video, Phil, that just absolutely, it was a white knuckle kind of video. It was these autonomous cars in a virtual environment. Okay, so it's not. I mean, there aren't really 100 autonomous cars in existence, probably.
Right.
But they were in this virtual. They were in this virtual environment, and they all were being, controlled by each individual avatar in this environment was being controlled by a separate computer, and they were going through an intersection all at the same time. No red light. You know, I mean, it was just. It's zoom, 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 shuffling in and out. I mean, missing each other by a foot. And I was just, you know, I can imagine this would actually work. I mean, it was showing it was working. You know, it was working there in this virtual environment. But my gosh, Bill, can you imagine?
I can't. This is where I actually become a little bit of a Luddite. I would prefer to be deeply engrossed in reading material or watching a video screen while that's occurring if I'm going to be in a vehicle where that's going on. Or better yet, let's just keep the lights. I understand it would be more efficient that way, but I'm okay with it not being quite that efficient. How does it work effectively? Every intersection becomes a yield sign? Is that the idea? Or
well, it's not even a yield sign. I mean, since every vehicle has perfect awareness of every other vehicle, and it's all mapped out, you know, how you're going to get through this. And it was amazing, Phil. It wasn't even, you know, these vehicles, you know, they were actually swerving in the intersection to avoid the other car that was coming. I mean, it wasn't even
right.
That they were going straight through and shuffling, you know, and maybe slowing before entering the intersection. They were going in the intersection at full speed, and, you know, he'd swerve about a 30-degree swerve to avoid the car, you know, that it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. Again, I just don't, you know, it just probably would be too nerve-wracking, at least initially. You know,
it is a scary thought. Yeah. Well, particularly in your line of work, having seen what you've seen,
Exactly.
You know, the idea of vehicles just blasting through intersections, I mean, is a scary thought, but it's the future. you know, it's one of the advantages of robot cars. I think we'll probably see it.
Absolutely. But I found it interesting. Yeah, there's more stuff, though. I mean, let me go ahead and say it. Japan looking for a space elevator by 2050.
All right, tell us about this. What do you got? Japan.
Not too much.
Now, when they say a space elevator, they mean the real thing. It's going to be in stationary orbit on top, with a chain all the way to the ground, with elevator cars going up and down into orbit from Earth. Is that what they're talking about building? Wow.
That's right. And a carbon nanotube elevator. It's basically a very thin ribbon going all the way up to a quarter. The counterweight that holds the thing up is a quarter of the way to the moon. That's how far this thing is. Now, the space station that you would go to is less than halfway to the counterweight.
Huh.
And you know, you're in low Earth orbit long before you get to the counterweight.
Right.
And then right there, you know, and there at that space station, they you know, part of the plan is to have a power station, solar power station, that beams power back to the base to run the cars up and down this thing. So it's, you know, I find it neat that they're planning. It's certainly a long range goal. 2050 is still, you know, it's what is that, 48 years from now?
38.
So we're you know, this is not by the end of the decade or anything, but
no.
But I think it's neat that they're planning it, and I think it's one of these things that once one country has it, I mean, more of these things will start popping up. It'll be much cheaper to make the second space elevator, put it that way, than the first.
For sure. Yeah.
You know.
That'll be the prototype that leads to a lot of things. But let's think about that. What was going on 38 years ago? Let's put this in context. When was 38 okay. years ago? 40 years ago was 1972.
Well, we just had the 40th anniversary, I believe, of John Glenn's orbital flight, right? That was 40 years ago.
That was 50 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was in 62. So
okay,
it would have been 1974.
74,
so.
Yeah. My math is off tonight.
That
was basically the last time we went to the moon. That's roughly.
Yeah, end of the moon, you know, like things like Watergate were going on, right? Vietnam War was wrapping up. So, you know, 2050 is no longer the distant future, right? We're as close to a space elevator now as we are to Watergate in time.
Yeah.
Right? That's pretty amazing. If it pans out. And I think that there's no reason to think that it couldn't, that we couldn't achieve that. That's going to be a major transformative technology. That's something, you know, this is our call sign and our hello and our goodbye on this program. But that is something I truly want to live to see. That is a development that I hope I make it to. I'd love to ride it, but even just to live in a world that has it, I think would be pretty exciting.
Well, let's see. I would be 80. I would be 80. So, I got a chance.
Surprisingly, I would even be older than that. That's the weird thing.
I would
be older than 80. Yeah. That's the odd part.
And doing quite well. If some of these other things we want to talk about are as big as I think they're going to be. For example, just this
well,
week.
Well, actually, while we're on the subject of getting old, let me talk about a couple here real fast, because
okay.
I've started a series on Extend Your Life Now. I think you've probably seen a couple of those. And
yep.
I would draw your attention to the piece by our good friend Sonia Arison called The Longevity Dividend, where she's talking about the financial benefits of having people live longer. And it was kind of a counterpoint to a piece I had put up a couple days earlier by Aubrey de Grey talking about the huge expenses involved in having people age. So 2050 is a good year to look forward to having some pretty credible life extension technology going on by then. You know, you might be a very spry 80 come 2050, Stephen. And assuming you are, and I'll be a very lively 88, you know, is where I'll be at that point. It's advantageous for us economically if that's the case. If you and I are, say, roughly as youthful as we are today, or you know, considerably great from how we are today, but still vital and able to participate, still able to do things like what we're doing right now. That is great for the economy. It's great for the economy because we're not in hospital rooms, we're not in hospital beds, and we're not absorbing all the costs that people, incurring all the costs that people incur. Aubrey talks in particular about the final year of people's lives, which is the most expensive. So if you can avoid having that last year of your life, you really do a lot to help the economy. But the flip side of this is something I had never thought about, and it's really interesting. She quotes University of Chicago economists Kevin Murphy and Robert Topol, and they've got this calculation that shows that gains in life expectancy over the century were worth $1.2 million per person to the current population. So if you add that out just from 1970 to the year 2000, the gains in life expectancy that occurred just over that over those 30 years, $3.2 trillion per year in additional national wealth, because of the fact that people were living longer. Why? Because the people who have the greatest amount to contribute to the economy are people who've gained the experience and who are able to, make the big decisions, make the kind of keep the wheels going. Every time someone who really contributes to the economy has become truly productive and contributory in that way, dies or becomes incapacitated, what really happens is you get pulled out of the economy, you know, sometimes 15, sometimes 20 years before you're actually gone. Somebody else has to come in and take so this constant replacing that occurs, which is good because you're getting innovation, but it's bad because you're losing all this productivity. So we've actually gained wealth, and they're estimating, I mean, that's a substantial amount of money, $3.2 trillion, based on the fact that people are living longer. And, of course, life spans are increasing much more rapidly now, and we're getting a much better handle on the kinds of things that that make us live longer. Just those first two that I published, and I've got another one coming up later this week. I don't know if you saw the one about intermittent fasting and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
Right. I did look at that.
Yeah, some research that shows, and we've talked about this frequently on the program, calorie extension. Would humans get the same benefits as mice in the lab if you significantly cut their calories? Would they get the same life extension benefit? Well, this doesn't answer that question, but what this does tell you is that if you go without eating one or two, possibly up to 2 days a week, you make your brain much, much more resistant to those two degenerative diseases. Does that extend the actual number of years you're going to live? Not necessarily, but it certainly extends how much of that remaining time is going to be vital, useful, productive time. And that's actually what we're talking about, is that drop-off that occurs. You know, somebody is I saw in the case of my own grandfather, he retired at 65, as he was supposed to do, and immediately began to wither away. You know what I mean? I mean, he had Parkinson's,
yeah,
which became very evident right after he retired. But it was just like there was nothing left for him to do, and you know, a few years later, he was gone. Parkinson's led to Alzheimer's, and then he wasn't with us anymore. So I think that the ability, to find simple things that are going to make us really resistant to those diseases are huge. And you know, that's not even the only story. We've gotten better all the time about Alzheimer's. There's another story about a drug that's making mice, essentially curing mice of Alzheimer's. But the other one, which I thought was equally important, was the amazing new understanding that's come about in the last 5 years around vitamin D. Now, we've talked about this on this show a little bit as well, but if anything,
Christine Peterson was talking about it, wasn't she?
And Christine has talked about it. And when we did the show about biohacking, self-hacking, we talked extensively about vitamin D. That was one of the tips right at the end of the show. If you're going to do one thing, what are you going to do? Start taking your vitamin D. And it turns out that is extremely good advice. If you follow the link on the site, the number of diseases that vitamin D makes you resistant to or builds your immunity against is just absolutely astounding. It's basically everything that you're worried about getting, pretty much, including the degenerative ones that I just talked about, but many forms of cancer, heart disease, and also just infectious diseases, which tend to wear us down and make us more susceptible to other things, kind of drag down the constitution. Also, people are reporting getting just a much better quality of life by having their vitamin D sorted out. It's one of these really amazing little things that got overlooked and that could potentially make a huge difference. I mean, if awareness of this spreads and people start getting the right level of vitamin D, we could really see an impact on, a major reduction in the number of people being admitted to the hospital for a whole lot of different things. It might even go, this is me being crazy starry-eyed optimist as always here, Stephen, it might even go a long way towards helping us with our healthcare issues in this country. Wouldn't that be a wacky solution to the healthcare problem, right? We just need everyone to either get them into the sun every day or take their vitamin D, huh?
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing. What does a bottle of vitamin D cost? I mean, nothing. I mean, it's like if you go buy generic vitamin D,
Vitamin C costs more than D, okay? Get the B complex and it costs more than D. Vitamin D is the best bargain at Walgreens, okay? Bar none. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Absolutely.
You take a dollar in there and you get change. It's ridiculous cheap. There's no excuse not to take it. And definitely. I'm up on the vitamin D.
Those are my two tips around things you can do to make your life longer. I'll be recommending more of them as I go. And I'll let you know a little secret about this. I haven't said this in the post yet, but everything that I'm posting about, I am personally doing. As the list grows, these are all going to be things that I am myself trying out. So this series could run for a very long time, since each one of them potentially extends my life. We'll see how.
That's right.
We'll see how effective they are. Okay, what else?
We plan for this series to go 200 years. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'm doing it for the good of my family and also for the good of the economy. And I want everyone else to consider the same thing. You know, fight these degenerative diseases because it helps the economy.
Okay, DNA sequencer the size of a USB stick, wicked fast and cheap at $900. So, I mean, that's a big deal. They announced, it was in Discover magazine just this week. And so, here we're talking about something. When Craig Venter decided that he was going to beat the government program, he basically had about a year or two left to go. And he jumps in with these, multi-million dollar machines and is able to tie them at least, if not beat them, in the goal of sequencing the first human genome. And now we got DNA sequencers that less than the price of a laptop that look like something you plug into your laptop. That's just amazing. And, we're coming down to the point that, put it this way, once everybody can afford a personal genome, that's when the personal genome actually becomes valuable. You say you're a billionaire and you can afford to have your genome, run 10 years ago. Well, what would that genome be worth to you 10 years ago? Well, I mean, you got a very expensive piece of paper that just says GATC. It doesn't necessarily, can't do much with it because the science hasn't caught up with it because there's not that many people that have that information. But when everybody has that information about themselves, and the science is just, that's when the research is poured on to find out what we can do with this information. And so it becomes, the age of personalized medicine is on us, in part thanks to things like this $900 DNA sequencer.
$900 DNA sequencer. So I could shell out $900 and get my DNA sequence. Is that right?
You would buy the sequencer, Phil. You could sequence your own DNA, and you could sequence everybody else too. That's what we're talking about.
So it's not just for the service. It's for the actual piece of equipment that does it.
And it's the size of a USB stick.
Okay, so we've arrived, right? I mean, we've arrived at the day, at the age of affordable DNA sequencing, right? I mean, every doctor should now buy one of these, right? $900. I mean, that would be relatively inexpensive compared to most of the equipment that a doctor has in his or her office, would it not?
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure that there are fancy stethoscopes that cost that, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, and so, what? You know, you can see why I'm so excited. I'm like, you know, talking fast and everything, in part because, you know, since last week, we've got a DNA sequencer that's $900, and we've got single-atom transistors. It's just incredible.
Wow. Those are two huge stories. Two great tastes that taste great together, huh?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about, just to swing it back to the single atom transistor. We were talking about a nano switch that consisted of like two or three atoms. It was the smallest piece of electrical circuitry, and now we've got a transistor down to one atom. Is there a projection of what happens next? Are quantum computers lined up to take over? Have we actually hit bottom? What do you anticipate is going to happen?
Well, with a single atom transistor, you don't get any smaller than that. That's as small
right.
as it can get. So that is effectively the end of Moore's law, and according to the article I read, it's about 8 to 10 years ahead of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Well, it's thought. And I'm not sure why this is science that's beyond this layperson's understanding. But it's thought that these single atom transistors will help in the transition to quantum computing.
Hmm.
I'm not sure why, but that's the thought. So, anyway, in order to make a computer better than the single atom transistor, you have to go with something like quantum computing. A traditional, you know, transistor type architecture computer cannot be any better than a single atom. You can't get it any smaller than that. So,
and if you start somehow using electrons, protons, neutrons, that you're probably at the quantum scale anyway. Is that right? I mean, you're probably talking about the same thing there. Right? If we start working down
into
quarks,
that's the
reason why. Yeah. Yeah, you can describe it either way, but at that point you're at the quantum level.
And perhaps you can entangle transistors. You know, maybe that's and you get quantum entanglement because you're dealing with single atoms at that point. I don't know.
All I know is making a prediction here. They'll keep working their way down. John Smart says eventually we'll be doing things at the Planck length. We'll have femto technology, and I don't doubt it. I don't know that it'll happen next week, but eventually we'll get there. So it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. Okay, what else you got, Stephen? I know you got a big list of things you want to talk about.
A machine that prints organs, a 3D printer for our the organs in our bodies, coming to market. That was in The Economist. 3D printing is a huge, huge deal. It's something that the Peter Diamandis and his co-author spent a lot of time talking about in the book Abundance. It's huge, and you would think, well, I've seen what these things are capable of doing. That's not all that huge. Well, yeah, it is. It's we are taking baby steps right now, towards something that's going to be just absolutely, it's going to be transformative of everything. We got 3D printers now that can do metal, glass, plastics, can put circuits within plastic, solid plastic. And we're even now doing organs, and that's pretty amazing. So,
one of the stories from a week and a half ago on Better All the Time was called Printing Out Body Parts, and it was talking actually about printing out a lower mandible, part of a jaw that was implanted into an 83-year-old woman, and it came right off a 3D printer and went right into her mouth. It became part of her jaw, and it's the beginning of the actual in medical practice use printing out body parts to use them. Another story that we had on there was about printing out muscle tissue, and this is really interesting. They're printing out muscle tissue such that it reflects the structure and operates in the same way as muscle tissue does in the human body, and this actually makes it much more accurate for testing treatment, much more accurate for testing drugs and those kinds of things. Because there's always been this way, you know, you can take a few cells out of a body and you can culture them, you can grow them, but you'll get a big collection of the cells, but it's this amorphous thing. It doesn't reflect the same structure that you see inside the body. To your point, if you can print out a whole organ, a heart, for example, you know, that is just adding layer and layer and layer and having each one be accurate and reflecting the structure as you go. This capability of printing cells on top of cells to produce to mimic the structure of the human body, ultimately it gives us replaceable kidneys, livers, hearts, lungs, all of it. And in the meantime, it gives us a medium for testing medications, for doing trials on treatment that are going to be a lot more accurate than anything that's been seen before. And, you know, I was in an email thread with Dave Goebel about this, the founder of the Methuselah Foundation. And he said, you know what, the guys who invented this one, they should also put in for that PETA X Prize. Because...
yeah.
You know, it was like, oh, muscle, you know, great. People can replace muscles. People can, you know, they can replace culturing cells. You know, he gets this idea. Yeah, actually, you could make meat that way too, and you absolutely could. I mean, that's one of the things that's missing currently from the idea of vat-grown meat is replacing that exact structure. But with 3D printers, they actually will be able to in the very near future, I think, print out meat, that will probably have as much to do with where our food will be coming from as our image of vat-grown meat, which we've talked about that a little bit too. So yeah, printers.
We have news about that. Did you hear the news that they're going to be marketing a vat hamburger by the end of the year?
Yeah,
amazing. You know, and there was like this poll: would you eat it, and would you, could you, in a train? My thought is, if it tastes good, yes, absolutely. It's going to be so much better for the environment. You know,
if it tastes like hamburger, I'll certainly eat it. If you know what, hamburger is all ground up anyway. I guess the question is, here's the question. It goes to this very issue. This is grown from a culture. Does the fact that it's grown from a culture and doesn't reflect that muscle structure, will that impact? Probably the two places it might impact the most are flavor and texture, and more likely texture, right? Because the flavor should be right. Chemically, it should be meat, so it should taste like meat. The texture might be funny, and that might be the thing that that messes with people. It might feel oatmealish or something, right, rather than feeling like...
Well, I don't want to gross out our audience too much, but it was about 5 years ago I first heard, you know, of testing of vat meat, and these guys in the lab, you know, are okay. Let's you know, here's our first batch of vat meat. Let's see if we can choke this down, and they said it was more like a tumor than anything else. You know. Can you imagine? I got a tumor on the grill here. It just wasn't working out. The guys could not. And these are the guys that, you know, are really wanting this to work. You know, these are the guys that it's their baby. You know, they want this thing to work, and they couldn't joke it down. Well, I think that the idea at that point was going, well, maybe we can do vat meat, but we're going to have to exercise it within the vat, because it's the exercise that gives the muscle the structure and the you know, the tensile, you know, it turns it into the right texture when you put it in your mouth and attempt to eat it. So you know, maybe that's what they're doing. But hamburger, I would think, would be a lot easier than a steak for that exact reason.
You might need the 3D printer. You might need the 3D printer to get you to a steak. That might be the trick there.
Maybe.
It's the opposite. Isn't that interesting? Because in the traditional world, you take a chunk of meat and you cut it up and you make hamburger, right? Now we're coming at it the other way, and we'll start out with hamburger, and eventually, when they get good enough, they'll be able to turn that into steak. That's,
you know, kind of... they'll 3D print the hamburger into the steak. Yeah, amazing. Yeah,
kind of the opposite of the way things have always worked. Okay, cool. Hey, you know what, Stephen? We thought we weren't going to get through as many of these as we hoped, but we're actually not doing bad. I think.
Not bad. Okay, 30,000-year-old seeds. Frozen right at the beginning of the last ice age. They dig it up, they plant them, and lo and behold, we got flowering plants from before the last ice age. It was a cache of seeds and various things that was buried by a squirrel. I think it's great. I've got the vision, of course, of the squirrel from Ice Age. You know,
right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can't help but picture him right in his acorn. Yeah.
Exactly. So, poor guy. He didn't get around to eating that particular batch of seeds. But that's kind of the whole point of this whole gag. He never gets the nut. But anyway, it's just amazing to me. One guy on NPR, a scientist they were interviewing, was extremely excited about it, saying this is a proof of concept that, you know, we can get viable, you know, things that have been frozen in the ice for many, many years to grow. Perhaps next it'll be a mammoth. So, I'm extremely interesting and exciting.
That really is.
Learn a lot from that.
Is there any practical benefit to growing 30,000-year-old plants? Are they extinct? Or are they just variations on things that we currently have? Did the article talk about that?
It did not talk about it. It looked like a very small flowering plant, little flowers that maybe an inch across, I don't know. It did not see whether it was an extinct species or not. But wouldn't be surprised if it were, that's a lot's happened in 30,000 years, right? Including a big ice age. So, would not be surprised if that particular variety is gone, except for what they've got growing now. So, pretty neat.
Amazing, yeah, amazing stuff. It moves us in the Jurassic Park direction. You know, if a mammoth is next, who knows? Maybe someday we really will be able to reach into amber and pull out the DNA of lost dinosaur species and bring those back as well. That becomes more credible. With each development like this, that we might see the return of the dinosaurs or other lost species to this planet, and that would be pretty amazing. All right, I did a couple of stories that talk about how genius friendly our world is becoming, and actually you've already talked about one because one variation on genius friendly is how friendly are we becoming towards machine genius, and the other flavor of that is how friendly are we becoming toward human genius. So looking at the human genius side, we had the story of Taylor Wilson, the boy who played with fusion. I think I believe Jab sent me that story. Thank you for that, my friend. Terrific, inspiring story about a 14-year-old kid who basically figures out how to make fusion happen. He's one of only 32 people who have ever done this, and his story is contrasted very interestingly with this similar story that you might remember from the mid-90s of the, what they call him, the Atomic Boy Scout, the Nuclear Boy Scout, something like that. This kid who was trying to do much the same thing, and the whole thing ended with the cops having to come in and the hazmat suits and people going to jail, and it was a big ugly mess, right? Here you've got this story, and it's just a fantastic success that this kid gets put in a special school. He ends up connecting with people at a major university. He's given lab space. He's given proper supervision, and he creates a fusion reaction and has proposed a system for using this kind of fusion reactor as a security device to screen cargo ships as they're coming into the country. You could actually have this big drive-through machine that's shooting these neutrons down at cargo ships, and you would be able to identify whether there were either nuclear weapons on it or whether there were conventional weapons on it because of the reactions of the neutrons going through. There was a completely new idea. No one had thought of doing it before. Homeland Security is very interested in his work. A lot of people are extremely interested in his work, and he appears to have a very bright future. And I believe that one of the differences between this boy's story and his predecessor, the kid who ended up in trouble and who was listed as some kind of cautionary tale, is that our world has become a bit more genius-friendly. Our country, our society has become a bit more genius-friendly. None of which is to take away from the fact that he's an extraordinary kid. He's obviously got great parents who have supported him through some things that maybe most parents wouldn't be all that supportive through. But the fact that someone like him becomes a success story rather than becoming a frustrated genius or an also ran or a thing that didn't happen, I find extremely encouraging. I think there's good reason to believe that that we've got the infrastructure now to handle genius, and we have to be able to handle genius because we've got as I talk about in that blog post, we've got Moore's law for mad scientists to contend with, which Eliezer Yudkowsky has explained to us is the principle that says that the IQ required to destroy the world goes down by 1 point every 18 months. So we know that people have tremendous resources at their disposal. People have tremendous amounts of information at their disposal. What are we going to do with them? Well, I'm hoping that we see a lot more of this kind of thing done with them, because what this kid has done is absolutely remarkable.
You pointed to another example of genius this week as well, Phil. Machine genius. Tell me a little more about that.
This is really exciting too. So now we're talking about the singularity is what, Stephen? One of the markers of the singularity is if you've got a machine that's smarter than a human being, right?
Right.
Well,
exactly.
Here we've got a genius computer with an IQ of 150, more intelligent than 96% of humans. So this is really interesting research that's being done. I believe it's in Boston. I can't remember now who the developers of this were. But you know, this is something that people have been working on for some time. How do you get a computer program to do well in an IQ test? It's a very similar set of problems to what the folks who built the machine that competed on Jeopardy were up against, right? There's language recognition,
right?
Pattern recognition. Well, these guys, they took a different tack and they said, we're going to include all of those ideas, but we're going to model some basic psychological principles into this computer. So this computer is going to be thinking more like a human being than any computer that's ever been built before. That was their theory going in, and now they've got a machine that outscores most people on IQ tests. Now, it still doesn't, it doesn't drive itself home and make itself dinner, right? So, I mean, you know, the question as to whether it's truly more intelligent than a human being, no, it's not, or at least not more capable in some ways.
It's machine optimized to take the IQ test.
It is optimized to take an IQ test, but with that in mind as like kind of our gauge of how smart somebody is, and it can beat us at that now, I think that's very telling.
Here's my prediction about this, Phil. You remember when Kurzweil suggested, he even gave the year it would happen, that a computer would beat the world chess champion, and he gave the particular year it would happen. It was 97 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he said, and the immediate response would be that chess would diminish in, the reputation of the game would take a hit, and that people would take chess less seriously after that.
Right, right.
I believe, and my prediction is, people will start taking IQ tests less seriously because of this. The way we're measuring intelligence obviously is not correct if a mere machine can do it. And for a time, I think that'll be one of the responses to this.
Well, you know that Jeopardy doesn't mean you're smart anymore, right? For the same reason, right? A machine won that, so therefore, this is my ultimate prediction on this is once the machines take over the world, we will say, well, yeah, but we never said it would take any particular intelligence to take over the world, right? I mean, that'll be
exactly
that'll be the argument there. Jab points out that research was done in Gothenburg in Sweden. Good call. Nice town, by the way. If you ever get a chance to get up that way, I've been there once before. And they're doing some cool work with artificial intelligence there. Okay, Stephen, we got time for one more quick one. Lay it on us.
Let's see. The Forgetting Pill. You remember the movie, what was it, Sunshine of a Spotless Mind?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, absolutely. Yeah,
exactly. Well, the whole thing was, he had a painful breakup that he wanted to forget. And I believe it involved a surgery or something so that he could forget that relationship. Well, this is a lot less invasive. This is a forgetting pill that someone who's been through a very traumatic experience could take. And then at the appropriate moment when the drug has kicked in properly, the psychiatrist or whomever is sitting with you has you go through the memory that you want to forget, and the very act of remembering it while on this drug will allow it to be forgotten. And, you know, I have a lot of questions about that. You know, for one thing is, what if you happen to think of something you don't want to forget?
Exactly. What if you take the pill and accidentally remember your wedding anniversary, right? Or something
that,
right?
Yeah, you know, and my problem is I would go in there saying, don't think of that, don't think of that. And
exactly,
that, of course,
don't think about
what
an elephant. Yeah.
Yeah, don't think about pink elephants. Well, you know,
yeah.
You're thinking of, anyway, so, how do you guard against that? I don't know, but I find it interesting that they're actually working on that. And the idea is, you know, this could be the thing that helps people with that are really suffering with things like post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, they have found that, you know, talking through these things doesn't help. And they've literally done the studies saying people who talk through these problems sometimes are worse off because the very talking about it causes you to relive it. The thing we really need to do is to forget some things. And if it's traumatic enough and if it's something that's interfering with your ability to live your life, you don't need to have that memory. So,
that would be the almost for sure good application of something like that. You think about in the movie, I thought it was very clever. People were using it primarily to forget romantic relationships. And it was completely failed because the people who would then forget each other would then end up getting back together, right, with this, like,
exactly.
Not realizing that they'd been together before. Sorry if I'm spoiling the movie for anyone, but that's what happened.
It's been out a while.
Or 8 years ago. It's like there's an awful lot of what's in our heads that we'd rather not think about all that often that still contributes in a huge way to who we are and to what our lives are and helps us make decisions and helps us be who we are. And we don't want to go messing with too much of that. But stuff that's just damage, things that are just there that do nothing but hurt us and can't do anything but hurt us, if you can get rid of those, I think that that would be terrific. Okay, we're going to leave enough time for music. I just want to announce very quickly that our program will be on Thursday, not Wednesday next week, because next Thursday is what, Stephen?
Future Day, right?
It's Future Day, so we'll be celebrating Future Day live right here on Fast Forward Radio, and our good friend PJ Manny will be along to celebrate with us. We're really looking forward to that, talking about this brand new holiday focused on the future. So please join us next Thursday evening for Fast Forward Radio. Okay, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
The music is No Problem by Darius Lux.
All right, Darius Lux with No Problem. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Great great title for a song on a program about being better all the time, No Problem. Thanks so much for everyone who listened, all of you in the chat room and all who've listened live, all listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back next week, as I said, on Thursday evening, and we look forward to being with you all then. Until then, live to see it.
What do you say? Where do you work and how do you play? Where you hidden and hey, where have you been? What do you like and who do you know? What do you see and where do you go? What are you looking at and coming out? What's looking at you? And said it's okay to do the very best we can. Right and wrong depends on you and me. Problem is, there is no problem. I'm gonna let it be. I don't need no drama, mama. I'd rather be happy. Yeah. What do you buy and what do you sell? Who do you kiss and why
what do you tell? What are you doing with your life? What do you eat and what do you think? How do you feel and what did you drink? What is wrong with somebody? Please tell me what is right. Instead of it's okay, seems like we are in control. It's alright, we're moving in the right direction. Break the mold. Now tell me, is there more or is that? Oh, but the problem is there is no problem. It's plain for all to see. Situations right or wrong depends on you and me. Problem is there is no problem. I'm gonna let it be. I don't mean a drama, mama. I'm gonna be happy.
Problem.